and I'm here with Brian Rosner, the author of the Top 10 Lyme Disease Treatments. We interviewed Brian for about a half an hour the other day, but we didn't get through all the treatments, so we're having him back. His book is subtitled Defeat Lyme Disease with the Best of Conventional and Alternative Medicine. And I think it really does take holistic alternative medicine to address Lyme's disease, as Lyme's is truly a systemic disease and needs many biophysics applications, as well as biochemical and antibiotic natural or regular drug therapy. Brian, do you want to tell us a little bit about your background, how you got interested in Lyme's disease, and how you got Lyme's disease?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. Sometimes I think we learn the most not from our own research. I've been researching Lyme disease full-time for about 5 years, but from others' research. We just published a new book. It's called Insights into Lyme Disease Treatment, and the reason that I learned so much from it was, instead of it just being based on my research, what it is it's based on the treatment philosophies of 13 different Lyme-literate medical doctors. There's one chapter for each doctor, and I just learned a tremendous amount. For example, the importance of treating biofilms, the importance of hormones.
Right.
I had Lyme disease when I was a kid, didn't know it, and eventually got diagnosed when I was a teenager and still lived with it for a number of years before I started to find the way out of the mess. I would say now I'm about 90% better. I work full-time, and I live a pretty normal life, but it was not an easy road, and I definitely wish that some of these resources were available when I was suffering from it. The new book, Insights into Lyme Disease Treatment, that I mentioned with the 13 Lyme-literate physicians, is really neat, because instead of spending the tens of thousands of dollars that one would incur to see 13 different physicians, traveling, hotels,
right,
you know, the whole runaround, they can sort of get a little sampling of what they would expect to find in those doctor's offices. So that's a pretty exciting new finding.
That's great. Well, congratulations.
Oh, thanks.
Is that book out now?
It is out. You can get it at limebook.com. That's LYMEBOOK.com, or on Amazon.com. And again, it's called Insights into Lyme Disease Treatment with 13 medical practitioners.
Great. Well, let's talk a little bit for the listening audience about what Lyme's disease is. We had, learned that it was an intracellular spirochete. Where do you think it came from?
Well, that's a great question. A lot of people might not even know what Lyme disease is. It's got kind of a funny name. It was actually named after a city in Connecticut called Lyme, Connecticut, and what it is, it's a bacterial infection that's primarily transmitted through the bite of a tick, so hunters and outdoor people are pretty susceptible to it, although don't forget that anybody who walks through areas of vegetation, grass, foliage, and that pretty much means 100% of the population. Yeah,
pets
exactly.
Bring it into you.
It pretty much anybody that does not live in a bubble can get Lyme disease.
Right.
And the conventional understanding of the disease is that it is just a simple spirochete bacteria that's easy to cure. But we've learned over the last 5 or 7 years of clinical research that it is, in fact, very difficult to cure. And as you mentioned, it can hide out inside cells in the body and in deep within tissues where antibiotics have very low penetration. And so it can turn into a chronic problem. Also, it can infect almost every tissue and system in the body, and so the symptom picture can be very vague and subtle, and so it can also be very hard to diagnose.
Yeah. Well, I had, I take care of a lot of people with chronic disease, and a lot of it originates in the biofilm around their breast implants. But there is patterns where, say, somebody gets breast implants, maybe they had pre-existing Lyme disease, or pre-existing mycoplasma, intracellular mycoplasma. And then when they get breast implants, of course, the immune deficiency that is there from those pre-existing infections and makes it more likely that they're going to get ill from their breast implants. And then some patients have breast implants, they get the biofilm, they get their immune system, their natural killer T cells go down, and then they're more susceptible to, and who knows if they had it before, but they develop intracellular infections. So I'm always on the lookout for these intracellular infections, as well as the chronic viral diseases. You know, there's a lot of hype out there right now about viruses causing chronic fatigue syndrome. I think that is simplistic. I think when your immune system goes down, you become susceptible to a whole host of intracellular infections, including viral infections. So I have a patient population of several thousand that are prone to intracellular problems, including Lyme. So
I think that's fascinating.
Right.
I think it's fascinating that you notice that the breast implants can develop biofilms, and those can sort of become a home base for these bacteria to grow and develop a little colony. And then from there, you know, the immune system doesn't have access to that sequestered area, and then the infection can spread throughout the body. I think that's exactly what happens in these chronic diseases. And the biofilms now, they're finding they can adhere to almost any kind of tissue in the body, including even brain tissue, as scary as that is. And so that really, I think you really, you know, hit the nail on the head when it comes to one of the fundamental beginnings of how this whole thing starts.
And mold is incredibly important, too. I used to do mold cultures on all these breast implant capsules, which were the scar capsules. And, of course, it wouldn't grow out anything. But then I called the lab up, and I said, hey, you know, I know there's fungus in here. And they go, oh, yeah, it grows out. It's just not pathogenic.
Mm.
Well, you know, it is pathogenic. It's not invasive, but it produces a biotoxin that takes the immune system out, and also the neurological system and endocrine system at times. So the biotoxins produced by these organisms, bacteria and fungus, can cause all sorts of very interesting problems. But we have very complex pictures, very, very, very complex clinical pictures. And many of my patients have 3 and 4 diagnoses. And unfortunately, traditional medicine can only handle 1 diagnosis at a time in terms of explaining everything. You know, if there's 3 different infections, they get a little frazzled.
Yeah, traditional medicine has developed over the last 100 years or so to be very narrow-minded when it comes to diagnosing health problems, and that's beneficial in certain cases when something, you know, when you can use a diagnostic model to figure out a hard problem, but it can be very harmful to patients that have a little bit of a lot of different things going on. You know, you mentioned the traditional medicine model. That's one of the hardest challenges right now facing Lyme patients is not the disease or the bacteria. It's the politics involved. And still to this day in this country, Lyme disease is believed conventionally to be hard to catch and easy to cure. And it's actually the opposite when you look at what the data says. It's actually easy to catch and hard to cure. So there's actually been a advocacy group that is a band of doctors, several hundred of them, that have formed a group called ILADS, stands for International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society. And this group basically sprung up out of necessity because, you know, these doctors recognize the importance of treating chronic Lyme disease, and there was so much opposition to doing that they formed a group, you know, to legally protect and defend and administer Lyme disease treatment in the way that it should be done. And so ILADS, you know, if anybody listening to this needs to go see a Lyme disease doctor, don't waste your time with the local doctor that tells you there's no such thing as Lyme disease, because you're just not going to change his mind. You want to contact ILADS and get a referral to a physician in your area. You can do that on their website. It's ILADS.org, ILADS.org, and you'll really save yourself a lot of time and money to go to somebody right off the bat that is going to help you rather than fight you.
Yeah, and I think it's important to tell the listening audience that the reason this had to form was because the medical boards were going after the Lyme doctors. And that's, you know, they were trying to take their medical license away because they were trying to help people with Lyme disease. I mean, you know, it's really interesting. A lot of these intracellular infections have their basis in biological warfare research. I spent 13 years in the Air Force, and I know a lot about biological warfare. And the idea of the intracellular route to have a population of people be unable to fight or unable to defend themselves is really an interesting one, and it's one that I think has been researched in our country, and I think things have been developed. We interviewed Dr. Garth Nicholson on many times on the intracellular mycoplasma developed at Port Dietrich that then showed up in Gulf War disease, and also the intracellular mycoplasmas showing up in autoimmune disease like rheumatoid arthritis. So this whole idea of intracellular has been suppressed research-wise at institutions and also at high levels like, trickling down to medical boards. Anybody who's trying to help people with these diseases can find themselves being attacked, not just by the local medical society, but also the medical boards calling them in and a lot of other opposition, which is very interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting, and what just totally blows me away is the oppositional forces that are in charge of creating, you know, the standard medical guidelines. It is a handful of people. It's about 5 to 7 people on the Infectious Disease Society of America board
right.
that are opposing these chronic Lyme disease treatments. And these guys, I'm sure they're very intelligent and very well educated, but they are right now standing against a massive amount of evidence in clinical observation and new studies, and they have been so aggressively challenged right now that they are, I think that they're in grave danger of, you know, the whole Infectious Disease Society of America losing complete
credibility.
Yeah.
Yeah, really.
In fact, what just happened.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
In Connecticut, about 2 months ago, they actually successfully passed a law that bans medical boards from going after doctors for treating chronic Lyme with long-term antibiotics. So,
good.
You know, the wave of change is here, and it's not going away, and it's time that these doctors wake up and realize what's going on.
Well, let me tell you what I found. In my patient population, long-term antibiotics has not always been successful because they become tremendously sick from yeast and fungal overgrowth. A lot of them have pretty significant fungal chest wall infections. It's in their lymph nodes. I had a patient the other day that I cut the lymph node open. It was black. You know, I've got fungal cultures growing on that. But in any case, just really can't tolerate the long-term antibiotics. I think the long-term antibiotics are a good solution for some patients, but not all Lyme's patients, in my experience. And so we've been trying to, you know, do what you did, which is find the better treatments through holistic medicine.
Yeah, I have basically two thoughts on that. Number one is I completely agree with you. Long-term antibiotics are usually not the answer, and it's not just because I don't like the long-term antibiotics or because I'm against them. It's because science actually shows that after someone with Lyme disease has been on the antibiotics for about 2 to 3 weeks, the bacteria go dormant and go into a protective
exactly.
form that's called a cyst form. So it's just that they don't work. So a 2 to 3 week course of antibiotics
is fine.
It can be great, highly beneficial.
Yeah.
But then after that, not only do you lose the efficacy of the antibiotics, you also get the side effects that you were talking about. But on the same token, it is important to fight for the right for physicians to use long-term antibiotics because that is the gateway for the recognition
the
of chronic
things.
Lyme disease, and then the acceptance of, we need to treat this, now let's start looking at smarter ways to do it. So, it's, you know, it's sort of just like the token fight to at least get our foot in the door.
Yeah.
But, you know, you mentioned alternative treatments, and that was exactly what I found in my recovery was that the antibiotics just helped to a certain point. I mean, I spent thousands and thousands of dollars on top IV antibiotics and wasn't getting better. And that was what basically sparked my, you know, desire to research and I have a research background and I'm pretty good at it. And so I was able to find, you know, a lot of different alternative treatments. And none of them were things that I discovered. They were things that other people discovered, but just had never really been written about. And so that's why I wrote the books that I did, to share the information that was already out there. You know, the top 10 Lyme disease treatments, that was a book that I wrote in 2007 that still sells, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 copies a year. That book has just a wealth of information on why the antibiotics don't work all the time and what some of the alternatives are. And, you know, most of it really is common sense. You know, give your body a rest from pharmaceutical drugs. Use supportive therapies like probiotics. Don't eat sugar. You know, don't consume junk while you're on the antibiotics. And there's a number of different kinds of probiotics you can use. For example, the ones that everybody knows about, the lactobacillus and the bifidobacteria. But there's also a yeast that's actually beneficial, Saccharomyces.
We use a lot of that. That's really good to prevent fungal overgrowth.
Yeah, it's a competitive yeast.
Right.
So it crowds out all the other yeast, but it's also benign in that when you stop taking it, it goes away. It doesn't overgrow. So, you know, there's lots of little tricks like that that people need to know about.
Yeah, when people are choosing a probiotic, especially if they're on long-term antibiotic therapy, even a couple of weeks, we recommend probiotics even if you're on 3 days, because people have such dysbiosis and gut flora problems nowadays. Just 3 days of antibiotics can wipe out important gut flora. We recommend a combination. You can look on your probiotic bottle and see how many different lines it has, make sure it has bifida and, lacto and some of the other organisms that are beneficial. But I think a mixture is what my patients do best with.
Yeah, I completely agree. Yeah. And this is such a broad problem now. I mean, the Centers for Disease Control estimate that there's only 20,000 new cases of Lyme disease every year, but that figure is laughed at by most of the people that understand that their criteria for having a positive Lyme disease result is so strict and so unrealistic that their tests are not sensitive enough really to pick up, you know, raging cases of Lyme disease. For example, the Townsend Letter for Doctors and Patients about a year and a half ago, they had a very thorough article with a lot of hard data on how the number is probably more like 200,000 new cases of Lyme per year, and a lot of those go untreated and unrecognized, so they build up over years. You know, after 2, 3, 4, 10 years, you're not looking at 200,000 cases, you're looking at millions of cases, and it's I would say it's probably not that far off to think that somewhere around 1 or 2% of the whole population of the country has Lyme disease, and a lot of those people don't know it. And so, some of the listening audience, if you or someone you know has an undiagnosed, mystery disease and nothing is helping, doesn't mean it's Lyme disease every time. There's a lot of other problems that can happen, but it certainly you have nothing to lose to at least find a Lyme literate doctor, get tested, and even in, people should be aware that even in the event that you get a negative test result, a lot of these tests are not that accurate, and the false negatives are common. And so what a trained Lyme doctor will do is they will put somebody with suspected Lyme disease on what's called a therapeutic trial, where they take a course of the treatment, which might be a short course of antibiotics, and they observe the patient, to see what happens. There was a gentleman in my hometown. I live in a ski resort town. A very rich man, really nice guy. He was a part owner of one of the ski resorts up here in Lake Tahoe, and he had a mystery illness, chronic fatigue syndrome, or whatever you want to call it, for 10 years. And someone, it wasn't me, but someone told him you should check out Lyme disease, and he took about a month of antibiotics and was totally cured. And that's not common. Most people need more treatments than that, but it just goes to show how some of these people are out there suffering needlessly because they just haven't been properly diagnosed with in this case, Lyme disease.
Yeah, I've seen that. I think when people have one thing, he probably just had one thing, that a course of antibiotics can be very, very effective. The problems we have, of course, are when people's immune systems are totally devastated. When you don't have an immune system, a month of antibiotics isn't going to really, you got to get that immune system back up. It's not just killing the critters. It's actually getting the body in shape to defend itself again.
Yeah.
And that's where holistic medicine comes in.
Yeah, that's right. And my motto when it comes to treating Lyme disease is always plan for the worst, hope for the best. So in other words, you hope that the patients are going to have an easy recovery and that they're going to be one of those simple cases, but you have enough resources to take care of even the most difficult patients if they turn out not to be those easy ones,
Mm-hmm. Well, we've been using, I think I mentioned this before, we've been using Dr. Overman's treatments, Limex, Cemento, the Harmonic Quad, and either Doxichlor, MMS, and having pretty good success rate with that in the patient population I described, which is primarily, women sick from biofilm problems. Mm. And most are breast implants, but there's other implants that are put in the body that create biofilms, obviously. any prosthetic device can have a biofilm around it. So,
right.
And it becomes fairly resistant to treatment once it gets infected. It can, you know, we're still looking for a treatment for infected prostheses, but in general, a lot of them have to be exchanged or removed, you know.
Yeah, I think it's just incredible how this stealth bacteria can become so resistant to treatment. I heard it said once that the best way to explain these bacteria to someone who's new to the subject or, you know, might not have the background is to say that they behave and have survival skills much more similar to larger organisms than to bacteria. Most people think of bacteria and they don't think of something that, I mean, you know, can engage all of these advanced survival abilities, but these are like creatures that can, you know, change forms and move to different parts of the body and
right.
and learn to avoid antibiotics and I mean they're very advanced and very capable of survival. And so I think one of the challenges is until there is a cure to be able to have enough treatments available to continue to combat the infections after they become resistant to whatever you're using at any given time, you know, to keep having more in the arsenal. And, you know, short of a cure, that's really the best we can do.
Yeah, what I tend to do, too, is use both biochemical and biophysics means. I think you wrote a book on Rife machine treatments.
Yeah.
Of Lyme's. And, you know, I think it's because I'm a surgeon. I think this way. You know, we don't just do one thing like medicine doctors do, which is use medicines. We actually have to use medicines to be successful in surgery. We also have to, you know, use energy. I mean, I've got these active patches that are electromagnetic energy that I give to my patients who can't tolerate pain medicine. You know, if some of my patients can't tolerate antibiotics, I give them homeopathics, you know. You have to know, surgeons are much more likely to use supplements. They use supplements in themselves, which is very interesting because most of them develop some, you know, like right now after operating 8 to 12 hours for all week, my body is like going, forget this.
Yeah.
You know, I'm 55 now, and so, you know, to have a week like this is rough. So we use methods on ourselves so that we can continue to operate. And most of my plastic surgery friends are very much interested in anti-aging and the fish oils and supplements, and you know they're always telling me that they're on all these things and their arthritis is getting better and their back pain's getting better and these magnetic pads for their back pain. So surgeons tend to be a bright group of people that problem solve, much like fighter pilots if you think about it. So if you give them a problem, they're going to try to solve it. So I think that I think that Lyme's disease should be approached like that. It should be approached with biophysics, Rife, and the harmonic quad, and other methods that don't involve chemicals. It should be approached with, the really, really important is getting the immune system back. A lot of these infections, including some of the viral infections, take the immune system out, and they kind of work in concert with one another. I think it's HPV6 or something like that will take the T cells out. So when you have mixed infections, it's almost like they're working with each other to make sure that the host can't mount a response against them.
Right.
And,
yeah.
It's complicated, and most doctors
yeah.
can't do complicated.
Yeah, so. Exactly. I think, you know, I wrote my book on Rife machine therapy almost 5 years ago now, and there's you know, a lot of people think, oh, that's wacky. What is that? Is that some kind of magic? Well, no. There's actually been experiments where it's been observed that spirochetes get killed under a microscope when they're exposed to certain frequencies.
Right.
But some new findings that I think you'll actually be interested in, given you're working with, you know, these implants and artificial devices within the body that can develop biofilms, is I just have been reading these studies. I'll have to email them to you, but there are a number of studies that show that electromagnetic fields wipe out biofilms on You know, for example, in sewer plants and things where there's a lot of bacterial growth, they use electromagnetic fields to purify some of the equipment. And it's thought that the biofilms consist of metals and minerals, you know, not even necessarily heavy metals, but different sorts of minerals and metals that, you know, make up the lattice of the biofilm and the electromagnetic fields, you know, that they some of these metals are slightly magnetic, and so they really kind of break up these biofilms. And so that's another clue, you know, for actual scientific, you know, finding out scientifically why the rice machines work. And so I think it would be really interesting to see in your field, you know, how a strong electromagnetic field might work on somebody with that's developed a biofilm. And these studies are all, you know, right there to be looked at in peer-reviewed journals. And they're, you know, it's just amazing that they don't use that in human medicine.
Yeah, I'd love to see those. I've got that textbook on biofilms that just came out. Have you seen that?
I just glanced at it online, yeah.
Yeah, I've got that. And there's something, biofilms form, like you say, not just around implants, but also within tissues. I think I've got biofilms in my sinuses right now, as a matter of fact. But it's, you know, it's important to understand that things are a lot more complex than just simply you have a single bacteria causing an infection.
Yeah.
And we do need to try to find biophysical methods to help not just break up the biofilms, not just be the, you know, like the killer rays, but also to help things that chi machines and other, you know, other organ type energy things that will help increase the energy of the area as well as the whole body. I do healing in my practice, and a lot of times patients will come in with an infection and I'll do a healing on them and give them an antibiotic, but a lot of my patients don't want to take the antibiotic, and just the energy from the healing makes the infection go away. So they come back later and say, well, doc, I never took that antibiotic, you know.
Well, yeah, you have a good point. I mean, there's a reason that these people develop the biofilms in the first place, and that's that their energy and their immune system is not as a healthy person's is. And so you definitely are, you know, in my opinion, correct about not just trying to kill the bugs, that there has to be a holistic approach getting these people back on their feet.
Yeah, there really does. And we try to look at patients health-wise in terms of will they be able to tolerate implants, especially these cancer patients. You know, breast cancer patients come in, you know, sometimes that implant is put in after the mastectomy, and then chemo started right away, you know, and radiation sometimes too as an afterthought. And yeah, we get all sorts of problems in the immune suppressed cancer patients that when we're trying to have an implant actually survive in their chest wall. So I'm real excited about the other methods that, you know, if you put an implant in the body or a prosthesis in the body, or if you operate on an area, or if you have an area that had an infection, the energy in these areas is lower. I know Valerie Hunt had a machine that could measure these energies in the auric field, and I think someday we'll be able to just scan somebody like they did on Star Trek and determine where they need the energy and then apply it through some means. But that's what I'm interested in. I'm interested in actually getting the energy in the body up to the point where it can tolerate implants. It can tolerate, you know, surgeries.
Right.
Not be such a guessing game. Because, it didn't work. Well, why didn't it work? Well, you should have known it wasn't going to work because the patient didn't look very good, you know.
That's a good point.
Prevent that complication. Or get the immune system up, patient's energy up before you do surgery on them.
Right.
But that's how surgeons think. I mean, that's just a little, you know, we want to prevent complications.
Right.
So tell me a little bit about your new book. I mean, you told us the overview, but tell us some of the things that are in the treatment methods of these various doctors that you looked at in depth. Are there ones that are similar across the board, or ones you want to talk about just because they're very interesting?
Yeah, well, you know, the new book, it's called Insights into Lyme Disease Treatment, and you can find it on Amazon or on my website, which is Lymebook, LymeBook.com. And it's one of the most exciting books that I have published to date because it's not just my opinion or some other author's opinion. It's actually a compilation of 13 what we call Lyme-literate medical doctors' opinions, and it was pretty amazing. We put an invitation out to all the iLabs doctors, some 200 doctors, to participate in this book, and I was worried that some of the chapters might be similar, too boring, you know, oh, we already read that in the last chapter. But it turned out that the group of doctors that responded to the invitation was a very diverse group, and we have quite a few MDs, a couple of different naturopathic doctors, Susan Mara in Seattle, and Nicola McFadzian in San Diego were some of the naturopathic doctors. Deborah Metzger in Los Altos, California, has a PhD and an MD. She's very versed in hormones and deals with a lot of women that have hormonal imbalances. Uh-huh. And so each chapter in the book really did sort of take on a life of its own and really develop unique insight into, you know, how these doctors treat Lyme. There were a few commonalities that were seen in the chapters. Almost every doctor said that using at least some pharmaceutical antibiotics is a must, and it really makes sense when you think about it because, you know, these bacterial populations have really grown out of control by the time these patients get chronic, and so while it is important to do all the other, you know, holistic aspects of treatment, if you don't lower that bacterial load right off the bat, then you just are so overwhelmed with the bacterial growth that there's really, really not much that could be done. I was surprised at the importance of hormones in balancing hormones. I just always sort of assumed that once you got rid of the infection, the hormones would come back on their own to normal levels. But a lot of the physicians in this book were really emphasizing the importance of balancing the hormones and using hormones for a while until the body can sort of, you know, take over the treatment. The book is actually divided. It's really well organized. Each one of the chapters asks the physicians the same question. What we did was, you know, we called all these physicians, and we knew that we were only going to have an hour or two with them, and we also knew that a lot of them aren't going to be able to just rattle off right off the top of their heads all of the things that they've learned over the years, you know, because they're busy and they can't do that. So we spent a lot of time when we wrote this book. The book is actually written by a journalist that publishes with my company, Connie Strassheim. But what we did was we came up with a list of questions, very insightful questions for these physicians so that we could draw out the wisdom that they have. Like, for example, one of the questions was, what is the difference between a patient you see that recovers from chronic Lyme and what is the difference between somebody who does not? Mm-hmm. And so that was the kind of question that really would make, you know, these physicians have to dig deep into their experience and figure out, you know, really what is it that they, you know, that makes them recover. We also focused on co-infections and, you know, like you said so accurately, that it's not just one thing or one infection. There's all these co-infections and cofactors. So we asked all the physicians what they use to treat Babesia, Bartonella, Mycoplasma, Ehrlichia, and all of these, you know, yeast and all these other things that came up. So we got a pretty broad stroke on those treatments too. And then, of course, each physician brought to the table their unique way of doing things. In some ways, it was kind of scary, actually, to see that 13 physicians really do it 13 different ways. And so it kind of leaves one wondering, well, if there's really 13 different ways to do this, which one's right? Or are there more than one right way, you know, and which doctor do I go to? And you know, you start struggling with the tough questions. But I think that's exactly what patients need to be doing. They need to be struggling with the tough questions. Mm-hmm. And that gets them into the mindset of taking care of themselves and taking responsibility for their own healing and things. And so I think the book, you know, accomplished that as well.
And I think it's important, too, when the patients read the book, intuitively they'll be drawn to one doctor. And they need to pay attention to that guidance because there could be a lot of different things we don't know about Lyme. I mean, that's still very possible. So it could be that intuitively they will go to the doctor that has the treatment method most effective for their situation.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right on that. I used to downplay the importance of that kind of intuition, but I really do think that there is a subconscious level where we sort of know where to go to get help, and it's, right, you know, an instinctual thing where we can really find that. And so I think you're exactly right. I think there will be certain treatments that people see in the book, mm-hmm, and they will resonate with patients on which direction to take, and that's a result of you know, intuition, and also patients, you know, just their overall awareness of their disease and what they've tried in the past, what's worked,
yeah,
what hasn't worked, and things like that. So I think you're exactly right. I think the patient is the best tool to kind of choose a direction.
It really is. A chronic disease is really a spiritual journey, and a lot of the way out of the spiritual, out of the chronic disease, is following this path of guidance. And you know, that I see that all the time in the breast implant population. They have some of them have had dreams that they have, actually their breast implants are making them sick, even though everybody told them that it wasn't. And decided not to kill themselves, instead came and saw me. You know, that was Catherine Gordon, who was featured in Glamour magazine and on a Canadian show called Vanity Insanity. I have 8 patient stories in my new book that's about to be published. All 8 of them were spiritually guided to me. So it's the rule rather than the exception. You know,
yeah, like,
you know, they pray about it. They pray and ask for help, and then help comes through weird means. And then they know, they have an inner knowing that they have to come see me. And my last patient went from overseas, was from New Zealand. So obviously it doesn't matter where you are on the planet. And she just posted something on a blog saying that she was virtually well now, and that was a couple of months ago. So if you have to go halfway across the world to get well, you do. I mean, you know, that's what you do.
That's so fascinating. What percentage would you say of people that get breast implants end up getting infections around them? Is it a high amount, or is it?
Yeah, eventually it will be. All breast implants eventually fail. Usually they fail between 8 and 15 years, although the new ones actually are leaking sooner, some of them anyway. And so the new improved models were not always improved. I know this because I have about 30 phone calls every day from all over the world for people who are sick, and of course I ask them what kind of implant they have in. So there you go. That's a nice little survey. But once they leak, if they have saline, if the valve becomes incompetent, they can get mold, bacteria, and, you know, whatever. And then once the silicone leaks out, there's about 30 different chemicals, as well as silicone, which has problems. And we talk about that in the book. But essentially, I'd say almost 100% of people with breast implants in that don't have them changed out every 8 to 10 years will get sick. So it's
a high percentage. Yeah, it's interesting that they probably never tell those patients about that when they go in to have these breast implants done. They probably only mention surgical complications that are very rare, and they just kind of conveniently forget to tell them, you know, by the way, you'll be chronically ill in 10 years if you get this done.
Well, the FDA came out and said everybody with silicone had to have MRIs, which is kind of silly because MRI doesn't show leakage. It sometimes shows rupture. 80% of the time they'll show rupture, but it doesn't show leakage. So they expect these patients to pay for a worthless test on their own. You know, their insurance isn't going to cover it. So I thought that was hilarious. I mean, if they really understood the science, they would really understand that their recommendations don't make any sense at all. But that's what happens when you entrust your health care to the government.
Yeah.
Be forewarned, you know.
Yeah, and it looks like we're going in kind of a bad direction that way right now. I think one of the hard things about, you know, these diseases is they're often very unpopular with not only the pharmaceutical companies that make all the money, but they're also unpopular because they're complicated, and they would by definition change the way that physicians have to deal with the problems. And I think that nobody is excited about having to do that. And I mean, for example, Lyme disease manifests as a number of different very you know, unpopular mental disorders, obsessive compulsive disorder, schizophrenia, autism. I wrote a book last year called The Lyme Autism Connection.
Really?
And I did it in conjunction with Tammy Duncan. She was the co-author with me, and she is the co-founder of an organization called the LIA Foundation, which stands for LIA, Lyme-Induced Autism. And she never even meant to start this foundation, but she discovered that her own son's autism was primarily a Lyme infection, and when she began to treat him for Lyme, he got better rapidly, and she found parents from all over the world emailing her and calling her saying, this, the same thing happened with my son. And so she contacted me to try to get a book together, and we got this, and I could not believe it. When I was researching the connection between Lyme disease and autism, I didn't think I would find anything. I thought it was pretty far out there, but there was study after study after study showing that moms who lived in endemic areas for tick bite exposure and Lyme disease exposure always statistically had a much higher chance of having autistic kids, and especially moms who had either active Lyme disease infections while they were pregnant or while they were breastfeeding. And there's just a huge amount of information on placentas being infected with spirochetes, and what happens with an adult when they get Lyme disease is very different than what happens with a growing fetus, and autism can often be the result. And these are just very unpopular topics that would change a lot about how medicine is practiced, and so I think there's a tremendous amount of resistance from all different areas in medicine to not look into this. And
well, you know, that makes sense, because we interviewed different authors and different people who are trying the more non-conventional approaches, and one of the people we interviewed, it has a system for remotely sending energy to people based on computer analysis type things, and he's having great success with autism. So you know, that would explain if somebody has a Lyme-induced autism, essentially you're remotely sending Rife frequencies, okay? I mean, they're more than just Rife, though, because Rife is within a certain range. But he's actually using a huge spectrum of frequencies, and he does it based off the photograph or the, I think he does it mostly off a photograph. And he's got a program where he'll treat any child with autism for free. So that's that would explain why that works, which is very interesting. I'm just fascinated by frequency medicine. I think it's definitely a lot cheaper, less side effects, and probably a lot smarter than filling the body up with chemicals.
Yeah, I think another thing that I think is so interesting about Lyme disease is there's this conventional wisdom that it only happens on the East Coast and in these what were previously known as Lyme endemic areas, and there's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy with that can really be harmful to patients in that what happens is you do have a Lyme disease problem in many other parts of the country. But since physicians aren't looking for it, it doesn't get reported, and it perpetuates the perspective or the idea that Lyme disease doesn't exist in those areas, whereas you take places like New Jersey and Connecticut and Rhode Island where it's expected to be found, those physicians are looking for it, and so they are reporting it to the CDC, and so it sort of reinforces this idea that, oh, it only happens in those places. And the physicians that are finding it, for example, where I live in California out on the coast, the conditions are perfect. Humidity, the temperatures doesn't fluctuate very much. There's a lot of growth by the water and the ocean and that moisture. And so there is a ton of Lyme disease there, a lot of ticks, but the doctors aren't looking for it. And so the doctors that find it there face such a huge uphill battle, unlike their colleagues in Connecticut where they have a bunch of support for it because it's common and it's accepted. These doctors are having a harder time reporting it and a harder time treating their patients, and so there's this sort of reinforced cycle of thinking that it only happens in these certain places. And, it doesn't make any sense logically. Why would it only happen? There was just a study. I just pulled this up this morning. I subscribed to a newsletter on new Lyme disease updates, and they took a cross-section of ticks in, I believe it was Connecticut, and they found that 90% of ticks in the Connecticut area carry Lyme disease and other infections.
Incredible.
This was just in this was in the newspaper this morning on I can't remember which one. I could actually pull it up here. It's still on my screen. But I mean, if there's 90% of ticks, you know, that have Lyme disease in Connecticut, why can't there be 40 or 50% of ticks that carry it in many other states, or even 20 or 30% enough such that it's a significant problem? And so I pulled this up right here. It's the Ridgefield Press, and it's Ridgefield, Connecticut. And this article was dated November 29th. The title is Lyme Disease Found in Up to 90% of Area Deer Ticks. So this was from less than a week ago that they just released these results. And so it would be my hope that the listening audience that you have here today would start to question, you know, is Lyme disease something that's rare and that's uncommon, or is it something that I should be thinking about and being careful about, and maybe loved ones that have chronic diseases start asking, you know, these hard questions about the prevalence of this disease, because in 10 years from now, I'm positive that it will be recognized as one of the most common dangerous, you know, things in the country. And there was just a documentary. I'm not sure if you've heard of it. It's called Under Our Skin.
Yes,
I have. Good. So many people have heard of it. It's great. It's really getting mainstream press. It just got on the short list for an Oscar nomination for...
Really?
Yeah, for Best Documentary. There's a list that's in the top five. And just to think about how amazing it is for a film on Lyme disease to make it into the top five, you have to realize there's thousands of documentaries each year that try to get into this running. And so... it's really hopeful right now that with this publicity and, you know, with that film getting so much attention, that there's really going to be a lot more recognition of Lyme in the coming months.
Yeah, well, I personally, just from what I've seen and read and heard about, I think Lyme is incredibly more prevalent than what is reported to the CDC. And, you know, we're here in Atlanta with the CDC, and the last time, you know, we reported one of my patients had Lyme, they sent me a little questionnaire, and it was really funny. One of the questions on the questionnaire is, how did you figure out the patient had Lyme disease? I thought you might like to know that. And basically, my answer was just that, you know, because she was sick.
Yeah.
You know, I just test everybody. I get them sick. If you're sick, you get a Lyme test.
Yeah, that's
and,
very smart.
You know, that's, you know, and about a third of the time is positive. So
mm-hmm.
I would say, you know, that it's, at least in my patient population, it pays to just do the test.
Yeah, and even sometimes those tests come back negative and they still have Lyme because the tests are looking for, you know, either antibodies or antigens. And you know, during a cycle of the month, the life cycle of this bacteria, there's only about 30% of the time where they're active and reproducing, and so the test might even miss them. And it's the odds are so stacked against patients that have this disease, politically, clinically, you know, with bacterial resistance and insurance not covering the treatments that they need.
Uh-huh.
I mean,
right.
It's like these poor patients are just, you know, facing this insurmountable, you know, obstacles in getting well.
Oh, it's true. And, you know, it's really important right now to understand the various assaults on our immune system and to counter them when we can, eating well and just taking care of yourself, resting, and, you know, doing some very other specific things that energetically will help the body, and I think you probably mentioned a lot of those in your, at least in the top 10 Lyme treatment disease book. So I highly recommend that. And you want to give the name of your other book again, real quick?
The one that I wrote, like you mentioned, the top 10 Lyme disease treatments. That was one that I wrote in 2007. It's still very up to date. And then the new book that we just published in September of this year is Insights into Lyme Disease Treatment. 13 Lyme Literate Healthcare Practitioners Share Their Healing Strategies. And again, that one, both those books are available from Amazon or my website, lymebook.com. And in this, the Insights book is just a whole new level of, I mean, for $30, you know, a patient can get inside the minds of 13 doctors You know, my colleague Connie Strassheim, who actually wrote the book, I did a lot of the work on publishing it. We looked at each other after this was done, and we said we probably wouldn't do this again because it was so hard to not only you have to interview the 13 doctors, which is a pain because they're so busy and they don't want to spend 2 hours on the phone with you, but also because once you do interview them and you go back over the transcript of the interview, it's not ready to be put into a book. They're jumping around, saying, hold on, I got to take a call, you know, and so you have to spend months and months going through their interview and saying what in here is really important and how do I organize it, and then you have to do that 13 times, and then you have to send all the chapters back to the doctors to say, oh, is this what you really meant? And they say, oh, no, I want to change that. And, I mean, it really was like writing 13 books with two authors. And, I mean, it was just a huge pain. But I think that now that it's done, I think it's just really worth
it. It's very valuable.
Yeah, it is.
Alternative medicine did something similar to that with cancer, a definitive cancer diagnosis, where they took, I think, I don't know how many, but the top holistic cancer doctors and outlined their plans. And the same thing happened in that book. The doctors had different approaches. It wasn't all one thing, which is interesting.
Although it is interesting. Connie, the author, she has a preface in this Insights book, and one of the most interesting things she said, I think, was that the effective treatments for Lyme disease can be kind of whittled down by looking at the commonalities and differences between the 13 doctors' approaches. You know, what did Dr. A find that Dr. B, who's in a completely different field in a completely different area, what did they find that was similar? And then you can look at that and say, wow, there really must be something to this, because, you know, these two physicians who were trained completely differently and look at things very differently came up with the same thing. And so I would encourage people who read this book, you know, to have a highlighter handy and, you know, underline things and really get involved with the book and try to figure out what is this saying about Lyme disease that is common among all these physicians. And I still haven't read it from, you know, that perspective. I've just been so busy working on it that I can't wait till, you know, I go to Texas for Christmas. I'm going to bring a copy of this book with me and just pretend that I didn't publish it and just read it, because it's so interesting. It's the first book that I've published that I can't wait to actually read, you know.
Yeah. Well, I coined a term for this. It's called synthesis medicine, and I did it in cancer. I interviewed about 30 different holistic and alternative cancer experts from all over the world, including Hulda Clark, who actually risked being arrested. She came over to San Diego to do the interview because she wasn't sure that the phones in Mexico would work. So I took 30 different people, doctors with really pretty many very large clinics, and interviewed them, and then I did a holistic cancer protocol based on the commonalities. that's what I do for fun. So you did in Lyme's disease. It's called synthesis medicine. You synthesize the best of everybody in the world, and you have to go worldwide too, because so many therapies, especially for cancer, are not allowed in the U.S. So you can't just, you know, you just can't look at the borders. You have to go beyond the borders.
Yeah, we had two doctors in Europe, and one in Panama City, and I wish that we could have even had more overseas. Because you're exactly right. I mean, they don't. The borders are a hindrance, because there's so many things they do in Europe that we don't allow here that are really good.
Or we don't know about here. You know, the homeopathy is much more developed in Germany than it is in the U.S. In general.
Right.
So anyway, well, thank you very much for joining us today. We've been talking with Brian Rosner. The book we interviewed him on was The Top 10 Lyme Disease Treatment. His new book is called Insights into Lyme Disease. Is that right?
Yep.
Insights into Lyme Disease, and that's one that every patient with Lyme disease should get and compare treatments of all these top Lyme doctors. Next week, we are interviewing Dr. Edward Close, Nature's Mold Treatment, the non-toxic solution to toxic mold. And Brian, the reason I have the sinus infection is because my crawl space flooded. Back when Atlanta had the flood. And so I really need to read this book for next week to figure out what I need to do to get rid of the sinus infection. Yeah. And then we're interviewing Dr. John Turner, who's a neurosurgeon, Medicine, Miracles, and Manifestations. That's on the 19th of December. And then on the 26th, we're interviewing William Norquist, who is a dentist, The stealth killer is oral spirochetosis, the missing link in dental and heart disease labyrinth. And I bet that biofilm concept applies to the teeth. What do you think, Brian?
Well, you know, I published Dr. Nordquist's new book that you just mentioned. And
oh, great.
We became instant friends because he was fascinated by the work that I do, and I was fascinated by the work that he does. So, yeah, definitely catch his interview. He is on to something big.
Yeah. Well, if you'll hold on after we go off the air, I'll give you my email address and also any other books you feel would be good for this show, we'd be happy to have on, you know, since you've got the publishing company. That would be great. Well, we also do not have Noetic Science on in December because people are too busy, but in January we'll have it the third Thursday of every month. I don't have the schedule in front of me, unfortunately, but thank you very much for joining us, Temple of Health Radio Show. We'll be back next week. Thank you very much.